Good evening, and good evening and welcome to the Charlotte Line. Boy, we got some great stuff happening tonight. This is Dr. John live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the Sun Fun capital of the world. I've got some great co-hosts with me. First of all, from Studio G in Greenville, South Carolina, Zach, how are you?
Well, I'm good. I had a drink from a $500 bottle of bourbon about an hour ago, so I'm fine. Just working hard and hardly working.
Hey, listen, buddy, I'll trade you a $25 bottle of bourbon for that, if you'd like.
Hey, it was at work, which is the best part. I was getting paid to have a nice glass of bourbon.
Well, that's good. All right, we'll have to have some bourbon soon. Anyway, great to have you here.
Yeah.
Brady Van Sickle from Des Moines, Iowa. How's everything going out there, buddy?
You know, not too bad. It was kind of a rainy day here in the Hawkeye State, but honestly, can't complain.
Well, that's good. That's good. We're glad to have you here. We're glad to have everybody here. I'm going to preempt programming for 60 seconds and tell everybody that one of my favorite projects is the Lizardman Festival. It started in Bisville, South Carolina, 3 years ago. It's hard to believe we're on the third year of the Lizardman Festival. It will be live. It will be remote. It will be done on Facebook Live. It will be Friday, noon to 5 p.m. Go to lizardmanfestival.com, and we'll give you the links to go to see that absolutely awesome, to hear that absolutely awesome Lizardman Festival. And then on Saturday, noon to 5 p.m. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I'll be talking. Lyle Blackburn, who wrote the book Lizardman, The True Story of the Bishopville, he will be there. He's got a brand new book out called Scary Swamps. Kind of cool. Talks about some of my favorite places to hang out with, like Scape Ore Swamp and stuff like that, places I like to go, especially with a camera. And then, but we're going to have a great time. We'll have Robin McRae and Janice Carter, the two Bigfoot experts. We're going to have Pop Maestro Wrestling. He'll be there talking about his career, and he's going to do a special presentation of the Mad Gila Monster on Friday night at midnight. So just check all the schedule out at Lizardman Festival on Facebook. So thank you very much. I expect to hopefully see my partners here, Zach and Brady, to at least drop by the Lizardman Festival. I hope every one of you can. So there is my promo. So you guys, can you know it's time to talk about wrestling? I'm sorry. I was just on Brady Hicks in the room. We were talking about wrestling. It's now time to talk about racing. Please forgive me. Don't anyone bolt. All right, who goes first? Which one of you goes first, Zach?
Oh, me. Pick me.
You just picked yourself.
Good. All right. Well, I think we should start off with we had three great races at Atlanta Motor Speedway this weekend. All three series ran, both the trucks with the full field, Xfinity running a 37, and the Cup guys running a full field of 40. It was great to see some great race action, and we're actually getting prepped for the first I don't know what to really call this, because it is now officially a one-off event. It is a short track racing on Wednesday night. It is the first time NASCAR will have a prime time, no lead-up, no specialty, no like Xfinity race or anything on a Monday or Tuesday. From Sunday to Wednesday, this past Sunday we had the Cup guys in Atlanta, and now this Wednesday we will have them at Martinsville tomorrow night. And I don't know what to think about. I mean, I'm ready for some racing action, but we're getting in the middle of the week now. I'm excited.
Oh, and what a great venue that we have coming up for us tomorrow. We're going to the most legendary short track in all of NASCAR, the Martinsville Paperclip in beautiful Virginia, for its first official start-to-finish race under the lights. They've really put in a good amount of effort these last 2 years getting that Moscow lighting system prepared at that half-mile track, really getting it primed and ready for what's going to be a spectacular show under the lights. It's going to be beaten and banging, short track style. The short track package has been proven to be a really good success so far this year, and I'm ready for it. But like you said, we had three great races this past weekend, and what better place to start than on Saturday early afternoon, the first of a doubleheader at Atlanta with the VetTix Camping World Series 200 for the NASCAR Gander Outdoors Truck Series. And Zach, lead us off. What kind of race did we see on Saturday?
Well, it was 136 laps long, and I think it was a decent race. It was just under 2 hours long. We didn't have a lot of lead changes, about 14, but we had some Cup regulars in here. We had Kyle Busch, who, you know, the bounty was out there, but we also had Chase Elliott, who got the bounty. Both those guys didn't have the best runs per se. Chase Elliott later on spinning with just about nine laps to go, or just about five laps to go. But it was some really decent race action. A lot of beaten, not beaten, but a lot of, I guess the best way to put it is it was great racing all the way around. It was truck racing at Atlanta. You were using up tires left and right. And when I say using up tires, I got photos from buddies of mine that were working that race, and some of those tires, and Brady knows this, but John doesn't. The surface there at Atlanta is very, very rough. It eats tires like I eat pizza, all right? It just goes through tires really quick. And the fall off is quite significant. It's not like 1 or 2 seconds. Sometimes it's almost 5 seconds. And that's even, and I mean that's even with conserving the tires.
Oh, yeah. For you folks at home, literally picture a cheese grater, just how it kind of just marbles, you know, little pieces and shreds of cheese off when you put a block in there. That's literally what the surface of Atlanta is doing to these tires. And you see it a lot in the races where you see these clumps and balls of rubber kind of rolling around the track, especially up towards the top groove after they've been kind of blown up to the top there. That's what we call the marbles. And in a track like Atlanta that has such an aged surface that's so rough, those marbles get literally spewed everywhere because the tires are just degrading so fast. But that's what leads itself to such great racing. That's what Atlanta is known for. If you go back and watch any Atlanta race, you just see drivers struggling for grip, almost sideways, lap after lap, and that's what really sets Atlanta apart from other mile-and-a-half tracks because it looks, you know, from the aerial shots, very similar in configuration to Charlotte, which where we were at just a couple weeks ago. But due to that surface and just the weather conditions down in Alabama really aging that surface, it just creates a whole different style of racing, and it really truly separates the great drivers from the good drivers. And that's kind of what we saw with the Truck Series race. Obviously, a lot of the first two stages were dominated by Chase Elliott and Kyle Busch, because while they didn't have great finishes, as Zach alluded to, they were kind of the men in charge for most of the race. Kyle Busch especially was out front for quite a bit of it. His number 51 Toyota, if I look down my finishing order here, he was credited with leading 37 of the 136 laps. Chase Elliott, just a few positions behind him, you know, he also had a strong running with about 16 laps to his credit. But they were kind of put to the side by a lot of the series regulars. Guys like Austin Hill, who led just one lap shy of leading the most laps to Kyle Busch, 36 laps to his credit. Kyle Busch's driver and teammate, Christian Eskes in the 18, he led 18 laps. Ross Chastain led 17 laps. So we were seeing a lot of drivers kind of stealing the spotlight and really flipping, you know, the story on its head of what people expected out of this race. And that's, to me, what made it such a quintessential good race. And that's what really sets the Truck Series apart from the Xfinity Series in the development pipeline, is that you really see just a whole different style of racing that truly puts a driver like Kyle Busch and Chase Elliott to the ultimate test with the series regulars that wrestle these trucks week in and week out.
Oh, for sure. And just looking at the top, I mean, Kyle Busch and Chase Elliott finished 20th and 21st. I mean, that's for two Cup guys and grade A equipment. And we've seen it at Charlotte and at Las Vegas and at Daytona and at every other track that we run at. GMS, which is what Chase Elliott ran, and Kyle Busch Motorsports, which obviously is what Kyle Busch ran, are dominant trucks. They are fantastic trucks. Brett Moffitt runs for GMS and has done very well winning for that team. And it's not like GMS has never won a championship. Johnny Stoddard got them a championship, and they've had amazing runs and amazing wins. But just the top 10 alone, the winner, Grant Infinger, Austin Hill, Chris Neck, Todd Gillen, Zane Smith, Ross Chastain, Derek Cross with a career best finish, Brett Moffitt, Ben Rhodes, and Stuart Friesen, top 10, all regulars, and in fact, a couple rookies. You know, it's just that, and also the rookies, you need to look at the rookies. Chris Neck, you know, full-time rookie, Zane Smith, full-time rookie, Derek Cross, a full-time rookie, all in the top 10, and two of those guys are also in the top 5. I mean, it was just a dominating force for all teams, but especially just the Truck Series regulars and rookies. It was quite surprising to see, you know, some of these rookies especially being up there in the top 10.
And that's something that I've really noticed about the 2020 season as it's progressed. Kyle Busch now has been in 3 of the races that we've run so far this season, the 4 races we've run, and they've not let up on him. Aside from a pretty convincing win at Las Vegas, the last 2 outings, Kyle Busch has definitely had his hands full, especially with drivers like Austin Hill, who's had an amazing start in his number 16 Toyota. Arguably one of the most highly, you know, scrutinized drivers in this division, especially with the circumstances of him coming into that team a year after Brett Moffitt won a championship for Shiggy Ettore. Many people questioned why were they going to replace a 5-time winner that season and champion in Brett Moffitt with a driver coming out of the ARCA series. But Austin Hill really put those naysayers to bed with an impressive 2019 campaign, and he's been backing that up this year by proving it was no fluke. And honestly, my heart broke for him. He was in the best position all race, dominated the event aside from Kyle Busch, and with that late race caution, with, like you said, with Chase Elliott spinning out with 5 laps to go, that set up the overtime for Grant Infinger to put up an amazing last 2-lap battle. If you have not checked out the finish of this race, go to YouTube, go watch that right now, because the battle between Grant Infinger, Austin Hill, and even Christian Eckes was one of the best 3-way fights I've seen for the lead in quite some time. And you got to also applaud the effort of Grant Infinger. He really drove it in there, knew that Austin Hill had the better truck, and really forced him to use up that truck equipment on that restart, and it prevailed for him. He got the win, and that's going to be his second win in 4 races this year. And this was a team that was really bitten by the winner's circle last year. They went winless despite having one of the most consistent trucks week in and week out. Grant Infinger in that 98 team, they won the regular season points title without a single victory because they were so consistent. But then the consistency went away in the playoffs. They didn't have wins to fall back on, and they were eliminated after 2 rounds, which was just heartbreaking. And so you could really see that whole 4-4 team, they have been fired up. They knew that they did not get the wins that they felt like they deserved last year, even though they won the championship. They won it with a winless driver, and that bugged them. You know, they were a team that has been around the Truck Series division, honestly, since the inception, and they take pride in being a Truck Series regular team, a Truck Series-only team, and being one of the best. So they've really worked hard on those Ford F-150s, and you see that speed, and not just Grant Infinger with his 2 wins, but also Ben Rhodes. He's been a weekly and week-out contender. Also, their other driver in the 88, Matt Crafton, our defending champion, he's not had the best of years, but he's been solid, just as always Matt Crafton is. So it was great to see that great team with Thor Sport Racing get another win after suffering through a winless drought last year, aside from a couple wins by Johnny Sauter. It's nice to see them bounce back like this.
Well, and that's a weird thing, too, to say a champion, a driver winning a championship and not winning any races. Matt Crafton did it last year, and I'm going to credit a guy, Danny B. Talks on YouTube. He actually went in depth about Matt winning the championship without, someone else? Oh, man, it's going to drive me crazy. But follow in the NASCAR community, made a video about Matt Crafton, Matt Crafton winning the championship.
Darian Gilliam of Black Flags Matter, a fantastic YouTube channel, he did one about Matt Crafton winning the championship being winless and kind of how it exposed the NASCAR new playoff system. And I thought that video was really well put together.
That is it. Black Lives Matter is exposing the system, the Matt Crafton story. And that's, you know, listen, Matt Crafton's the champ, is a back-to-back champion. He's the first driver to do that in the Truck Series. Gets the third championship, doesn't win. But you're right. Thor Sport was hungry to get those wins because they wanted to show that, you know, they're still a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, they're one of a few teams in NASCAR in general. And I mean in general, that is not in the North Carolina area, not North or South Carolina. They are in Ohio.
Midwestern, you know, baby.
Yeah, like you know, they're a team that has been in Ohio. They've never had a shop in the South. They've never done this. They've never done that. And they've won championships. They've won races. They've been in the series for so long, and they're still hungry to show, hey, we're a force to be reckoned with. They definitely showed it. I think another force to be reckoned with is the Nice Motorsports. Now, Nice ran Ford trucks, which was very interesting because Nice really started off with one or two trucks, went to two trucks full-time, did a third truck here and there, then did a third truck full-time, never did a fourth-time truck. Now, after this, they've done a fourth-time truck, their best one being Ross Chastain finishing sixth and almost getting them a champion last year, which that's still a fantastic one for him. Then you had Ryan Truex finishing 13th, which is a really good run for him. Ty Majeski finishing 19th, who wasn't the best run for him, but he's still someone that is a rookie in the truck series. He hasn't run that many races in general for the trucks, but he's someone that can learn really fast. If you look at his ARCA stats, he won a bunch of ARCA races and was able to pull kind of some really dramatic finishes in the ARCA series as well out of nowhere. And then you had Natalie Decker. That's all I'm going to say.
Not Natalie Decker. Jeb Burton.
You're right. You are right. But he still finished 16th. All trucks finishing top 20. All of them coming home in one solid piece. And for a team that's relatively new, and I do mean that, Nice had been running for a few years now, but not as many as people think. And last year getting their first win with or the year before getting their first win, then last year competing for a championship. I think they're still wanting to compete for a championship, and they will. They have Ryan Truex running full time for them, or not Truex, Ty Majeski.
Yeah, you're right, Ty Majeski.
It is just Ty Majeski. Which I do wish they would field a second driver for them to possibly get a championship. But still, the names that they have, Ryan Truex, a fantastic driver, Ross Chastain, a fantastic guy, Jeb Burton, even a pretty decent truck series driver. His stats, you know, when he first started aren't the best, but every time he's gotten a truck with Nice, he's been performing well, and I think they're going to be a championship team contender in the next couple of years. They just need to get one or two solid drivers full time, not just one. They should get two, in all honesty, in my opinion. But still, you see a staple in NASCAR Truck Series, Thor Motorsports, and then Nice coming along and doing some fantastic things. It's crazy to see what the Truck Series can actually build off of, I think.
And also, one of the greatest things I took away from the truck race was that even though we had a lot of amazing side-by-side action, it came down to an overtime restart, and the drivers were struggling at the very edge of grip. It was a relatively, you know, caution-free and calm race overall. Looking through that caution flag breakdown, we only had six caution flags total, two of which being the stage end brakes for stage one and two. The other four were for one truck incidents. The first two caution flags flying on lap 3 and lap 13, both for the number 28 Chevrolet, this week driven by Brian Dusant. He just lost the control of the truck both times and went for a single truck spin and didn't take anyone out from him around him. Then we went had another spin at the on lap 53 by the number 22 of Austin Wayne Fell. He lost control of his number 22 coming off of turn 4. But again, just like with the number 28 incident, no other trucks were swept up in that, and we kept going. And then, of course, the final caution flag flying with five laps to go on lap 129, Chase Elliott looping his Hooters Chevrolet for a spin off of turn 2. And so that's what really impressed me, was the fact that these drivers were struggling for grip. They were sideways most of the 200-mile event, but they kept it clean. They kept it off other drivers. And we didn't see any drivers, you know, days be ruined by a mistake by someone else. And that was so, just so great. And that's what I love about the Truck Series, is even though you have such a diverse array of veterans, rookie drivers, small teams, big teams, they race each other hard, but they take care of their equipment and take care of each other. And so you really got to hand it to these drivers for week in and week out putting on the show that they do for us.
And not just that. I mean, we did see drivers get into the wall, but nothing crazy. One of them being actually Kyle Busch, which was the surprising one, I feel. And that's really why Kyle finished so far back, 21st, and really one of the worst finishes he's had in the Truck Series in a very long time. But yeah, you're right. A lot of them, man, as someone that's been to Atlanta, I haven't been there for a race, Gesundheit. I haven't been there for a race. I've been there for just a little thing. But walking around and seeing how the whole track is and feeling the ground, to see them being able to use the few sets of tires they have to either conserve them or to use them, you know, whatever. The fact that there wasn't more cautions, there wasn't more crashed race cars, was fantastic to see. By the way, there was one driver who finished on the lead lap, and their car got disqualified. Johnny Sauter's number 13, technically finished dead last.
Yeah, and he failed on a technicality that I had not heard of. It was a NASCAR test that I'm not quite as familiar with, and I'm currently pulling up more information about it. But what it was is NASCAR performs a dunk test where they take your race used tires and they dunk them. I believe in just water, but I'm looking up to see if there's any kind of a solution they drop.
It is just water, yeah.
Yeah, so they dunk them in water, and when they do that, they're testing to check to see if there's been any modifications to the wheel that would give them an unfair advantage. And so they what they do is for this, NASCAR tests for this modification. They choose one team from each manufacturer to take the tires, and they just happen to pull Johnny Sauter, Timmy Hill, who was representing Chevrolet, and Christian Eckes, who was representing Toyota. But they took Johnny Sauter's tire off. They put it in the dunk tank, and it failed both dunks, indicating that there had been some illegal tampering. And due to that manipulation on the tire, NASCAR revoked their 17th place finish, and he ended up finishing dead last, as Zach said, with a disqualification.
Yeah, and
so that was
actually
bad luck. Just bad luck,
yeah.
Right?
Yes and no. So this is actually the first time NASCAR has performed this test. They actually did that during the championship. I remember Kyle Busch and Martin Truex Jr., but it wasn't the one where Truex won. I want to say it was a couple years earlier. But they do that because of tampering with the tires is obviously not legal. And one big case that people tend to sometimes forget, and Brady, I think you'll probably remember this, Ryan Newman at the Brickyard for RCR. Do you remember that case?
I don't recall that one.
Really? Wow. So so Ryan Newman's car, not car, his tires had microscopic holes to release air pressure. So that way they could set the tires a little better, and they would relieve air, kind of just like a relief valve on a water heater or on a air compressor. Basically, if it built up too much pressure, it would relieve it out, and once it got back to the desired pressure or desired size, it would then close back up. Ryan Newman's team was fined, I believe, over $50,000, and crew chief was suspended along with his tire guy. This is years ago back at the Brickyard, so it's no surprise. Yes.
So you are correct. It was a pretty hefty fine. It was 2015 after the Brickyard 400. And apparently throughout the 2014 season, there were a lot of rumors of what exactly as Zach described to you folks out there, the pinhole method to try and like mess with the air of the tires, simply referred to as bleeding the tires. And one of the most vocal teams about it throughout the 2014 season leading up to this Brickyard 400 in 2015 was Richard Childress Racing, the team that Ryan Newman coincidentally drove for at the time. And so when NASCAR found that they had illegally modified their tires to get this bleeding effect. They dock the RCR team 75 points and fined the team $125,000 and placed crew chief Luke Lambert on a 6-race suspension. And it's exactly as Zach described it for you there. But, yeah, this one had completely faded from my memory banks. I had forgotten all about this controversy. Good memory on that one, Zach.
Yeah, I have a $500 bottle of drink, and I evidently remember stuff. That's not a good time. But anyways, you know, that's so this method has been used. It's not it is nothing new, but it is a random test. So could teams now possibly be like, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing that? Probably. And probably be smart for them to start not doing that anymore. But overall, I really like this race. I love the Truck Series. As I said over and over again, I've got bumpers, doors, you name it. In fact, that 28th team is a New York Fire Department. I think the team is based in New York, and they love racing with the red, white, and blue fire department colors and numbers on there. So I actually have a door off that Brady has seen, and it's an impossible piece to get, and I'm glad I have it. But if you look down the whole list, which I'll run down the full top 10. So like I said, Grant Ingfinger, Austin Hill, Chris Neck is the top three, Todd Gillen in fourth, Zane Smith in fifth, Wash Chastain in sixth, Derek Cross in seventh, Brett Moffitt in eighth, Ben Rhodes in ninth, Stuart Friesen in tenth, the best finished Canadian of the week, Tanner Gray finishing 11th, Matt Crafton finishing 12th, Ryan Truex finishing 13th, Sheldon Creed finishing 14th, Tyler Ankrum finishing 15th, Jeb Burton finishing 16th, Brendan Poole, your favorite guy, Brady, finishing 17th. Ralph Lorenz finishing 18th, the second best finishing Canadian. And the last
Raphael
Canadian.
Lazard is how you pronounce
right,
his name.
Right, that one. Dang Canadian. Likes hockey and stuff. Ty Majeski finishing 19th. Chase Elliott finishing 20th. And a beautiful black and orange Hooters car, or truck, I should say. And Brady, you have to agree with me. That car looked, or that truck looked beautiful.
Oh, it did. The Hooters schemes the last few years have actually looked really good, and you love to see it because it's been one of the most iconic NASCAR paint schemes throughout history, going all the way back to the days of Alan Kulwicki, and they just always bring just solid-looking cars and trucks to the track.
For sure. Kyle Busch finishing 21st. Timmy Hill finishing 22nd in his own Clean Roofs Ford and his own team. That is his team that he builds himself. Corey Roper finishing 23rd. John Hunter Nemechek finishing 24th. Not the best finish for him, but only one lap down. Spencer Davis finishing 25th. Clay Greenfield finishing 26th. Spencer Boyd finishing 27th. Angela Rutsch finishing 28th. Corbin Forrester finishing 29th. Austin Wayne Self, after having that spin out, finishing 30th. Kate Fogelman finishing 31st. Bailey Curry finishing 32nd. Cody I always keep trying to say his name.
Roar.
I'm going to try this another time. Greg Golding, who made his first start in the Truck Series this year, finishing 34th. Jesse Little in the 97, finishing 35th. Jennifer Jo Cobb finishing 36th, who was actually black flagged and parked herself because she was going too slow. Jordan Anderson finishing 37th, who had an incident with the wall. TJ Bell finishing 38th, who had clutch issues. Brandon Dye finishing 39th, who had that crash early on, only finishing four laps. And Johnny Sauter, even though he finished 17th, will be credited with a 40th place finish.
And, you know, that kind of really wraps up the Camping World 200 brought to you by VetTix. So let's move on to that later on that afternoon and evening with the Echo Park 250 for the NASCAR Xfinity Series. And similar to the Truck Series, we saw a lot of, you know, dicey kind of action, a lot of drivers side by side. Not near as many lead changes and not near as much side-by-side action. It kind of got a little more spread out, but that is just kind of the deal that happens with the NASCAR Xfinity Series. But still, a very good race with kind of an unexpected winner. A.J. Allmendinger broke through for his very first ever career win in NASCAR on an oval and his fourth career victory in the NASCAR Xfinity Series. He's running a part-time schedule this year for Colleague Racing, and man, I got to tell you, the victory interview that he gave, AJ Allmendinger is always one that brings a lot of excitement to any interview he does, a lot of excitement to just the sport in general, but you could just see the elation on his face, the pride it gives him taking Matt Colleague's equipment to victory lane, because Matt Colleague has taken a chance on him, picked him up when he lost his full-time ride with JTG Doherty at the end of the 2018 season, giving him some great part-time opportunities last year and a lot more part-time opportunities this year, and it's paid off tremendously. And this is a team also that missed the season-opening Daytona 300. AJ Allmendinger and his teammate at the time, his teammate Ross Chastain, they had hub failures during qualifying. Ross Chastain was able to work out a deal to still race, but AJ Allmendinger had to go home, and then he wasn't entered in the next few races and didn't start a race again until last week at Bristol. Came home with a solid 10th place finish, but was not quite the night that he was wanting for. But all afternoon long, he was solidly in the top five, just kind of biding his time, and really the whole Colleague Racing fleet was primed and ready for a good race, with Justin Haley finishing third in the number 11 for Matt Colleague, and Ross Chastain finishing seventh in the number 10. All three of those Chevrolets have just shown so much speed this year, and it finally all came together with AJ Allmendinger putting on a hell of a performance to take his first win of the 2020 season.
And that's a big thing. Chevrolet has really improved. I feel like they've really improved all of their tracks. What I say that is their performances. I mean, Daytona is a track that it's kind of a crapshoot because of what it is. But when going to Vegas, Auto Club, Phoenix, here, Darlington, Charlotte, they hadn't always been the talking points or the, oh, yeah, they won. It's always been like, there was one that finished the top five. But if you look at the top five, four out of the five are Chevy. We have AJ Allmendinger, Noah Gragson, Justin Haley, Daniel Hemric, and then Harrison Burton, who finished fifth in Joe Gibbs Toyota. So we definitely see the Chevy package getting a lot better, but I also see Matt Colleague's team improving tenfold. Their first season ever was Blake Koch. He got them a pole. He got them into the Final Four. Then Blake, the contract expired. He wasn't in it anymore. And then they kind of moved around to people. But they've been consistently improving year after year after year, getting their first win at Daytona last year, getting a win with AJ Allmendinger a couple times on the road courses. A couple of them might have been disallowed, which just sucks, but this is a redeeming factor for him. And like you said, AJ's first ever win on an oval. Any race he's ran in NASCAR has been a road course. He's never had a win in an oval track, and it's not surprising for some people. AJ is a driver also who's ran a lot of different sportsman series, like in the Rolex series and SSCA. So he's someone that is a road course specialist, and yet he can come out to these oval tracks in the Xfinity on a part-time schedule and still perform like he's a rookie almost, kind of like I guess the best way to put it is someone that's willing to learn on the fly on how all this works. And man, if you would have told me last week, hey, AJ Allmendinger is going to win at Atlanta, especially Atlanta, I would have said, yeah, you've been drinking the wrong Kool-Aid. And lo and behold, I was proven wrong. And he led for quite a few laps, 37 laps AJ led. And the majority of them, well, actually all of them were from lap 127 all the way to the finish.
And, you know, while AJ Allmendinger experienced a great day, he was definitely helped with some good luck that went his way. The day was dominated not by a Chevrolet team, but by the two Fords that are competing full-time in the 2020 Xfinity Series season, those being piloted the number 22 by Austin Cindric and the number 98 by Chase Briscoe. Briscoe led 40 laps throughout the event and came home with a ninth-place finish, which was not anywhere near indicative of how great that number 98 Ford was running at most of the event. But even more disappointing was Austin Cindric. He led a race high 68 laps and finished a dismal 16th. Him and Chase Briscoe, they both encountered the same problem. On the final pit stop, they're right about lap 126. They came down to get fourth tires on the car, but both drivers were nabbed for speeding, putting them at the back. And while Chase Briscoe was able to cut through traffic and get back to a ninth place finish, the day was completely done for Cendric. His car was miserable in dirty air. He just couldn't get the passes to go his way and just could not recover from that. And so it was just absolutely heartbreaking for those two drivers, leading 108 laps combined out of the only 163 laps run. So well over half the event went to these two drivers, and they finished so far down the leaderboard. But as the old racing adage goes, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And in this case for AJ Allmendinger, he was damn well sure lucky to have those two very, very fast Fords run into trouble when they did, just paving the way for him to hold the other drivers at bay and go cruise away with this win.
Yeah, Ford leading the majority of the laps, 108 laps combined. And other drivers that led, Noah Gregson, 6 laps, Justin Haley, 8 laps, Justin Allgaier, 1 lap. You know, if your name has a J in it, you seem to lead some laps, it seems like. Kind of weird. You know, just looking down the list, especially the top 10, there's kind of a small diversity. It's not as big as I had the past couple weeks of, like, Jeremy Clemens and Ryan Sieg being in the top 10, but we still had someone very interesting, Anthony Alfredo, who hasn't had a full-time ride in any series, you know, but still a top 10 for him at Atlanta. And Atlanta, of all tracks, is a track that rookies don't really tend to do too well at, and especially ones that that's never ran at. There's some rookies who will get an opportunity to run a race here or there for a team. But Anthony, his Xfinity season is kicking off. Even though it's not a full-time season, he's kicking it really well in the butt. His Death Wish Coffee Chevrolet for Richard Childress Racing finishing 10th, I'm impressed by this guy, and it's a wonder how he doesn't have a full-time ride anywhere.
Well, and he's been really solid so far in his limited starts that he got. He ran in the Canaan Pro Series East full-time in 2018, and that led him to a couple of victory at South Boston Speedway and several top 10 finishes and a couple top 5 and a respectable fifth-place finish in points. That success that he had in the Canaan Pro Series led him to racing in the Gander Outdoor Truck Series last year on a part-time basis with DGR Crosley. And while he had some mixed bag results, he had several solid outings, including an 8th-place finish at Charlotte and a 9th-place finish at Chicago. And by running those races and really learning as he went, that's what led him to a part-time deal in the infamous number 21 Chevrolet for Richard Childress Racing. And in 3 starts this season, he has been electric. His debut race in the Xfinity Series came at California right before the COVID break, and he finished 6th in his debut race with Richard Childress Racing. He was then in the car when we came back at Darlington after the COVID break, and with no practice and no laps at Darlington, the kid came away with a 14th-place finish, and now in his 3rd start, a 10th-place finish at Atlanta. The driver just continues to impress week in and week out that he is able to get behind the wheel of a truck, a car, whatever you put him behind. He's finding a way to make speed, and just this natural ability is so impressive, and that's what's really going to open some doors for him because, like you said, Zach, he's not been given any full-time opportunities hardly, really no time to really develop his skills behind the wheel of a NASCAR on these paved ovals, and so it's been a very steep learning curve for Mr. Alfredo, and you got to count me as a bandwagoner on his career because I'm impressed. He's got the natural ability, and if you can race your first 3 starts of your Xfinity Series career, and arguably some of the hardest tracks to drive because California and Atlanta have 2 of the oldest surfaces, pavement-wise, in all of NASCAR. So those tracks are completely undrivable, completely slick as all get-out, and he's getting top 10 finishes at those tracks. And then the hardest track to drive, in my opinion, Darlington, where you literally have to drive both corners completely differently, he gets a solid 14th place at that race, with no practice, no qualifying, no testing, a 14th place finish at Darlington. Do not take your eyes off of Anthony Alfredo. He's got a few more starts left in the year for the 21 in Richard Childress Racing, and I wouldn't be surprised if they find some sponsorship to maybe start running him in a couple more events because he would definitely earn those opportunities if they get presented to him.
Brady.
Oh, for sure.
Brady. I got to tell you something. I don't know if bandwagoner is a word, but you just made it one, and it's correct.
Exactly. Making up words here on the Charlotte line.
No, I don't think I've ever heard it, and it's not in the dictionary, but it's correct. Bandwagoner is one who bandwagons. Go Brady.
Well, let's go politics the dictionary. Let's get it added.
Well, okay, well, we'll do it. We'll call I'll call Merriam and you call Webster.
There we go. We'll tag team it.
God, that was no, wrong show. No, wrong show. You got to wait till Papa Stroh's around. We'll talk about wrestling then. Okay. Back to you guys.
Let's
know I'm alive here, you know. Bandwagoner.
But
I love it.
You are absolutely right there, Brady, because Anthony's, you know, if you look at his starts, he's only got the only wins he actually has is technically in some Cars Tour events and the K&N series. He technically has a day job. He does sim rig setups, and I can't remember who it was that talked about him at California, but it was one of the guys on Fox talked about how this kid came in and put an iRacing setup in one of the broadcasters' place. He says, "Oh yeah, I race." He says, "Oh okay," and then he figured out who he was once Anthony got to the track at Auto Club. Like, "Oh hey, he's the kid that was just at my house putting up an iRacing rig." It's just one of those funny things. So he has a regular day job. He's racing. He's kind of taking some steps on Dale Earnhardt Senior. Not comparing him fully, but he works his normal day job, and then he does because he loves it, has a passion for it, and possibly will have a career in it someday. But if you keep looking down the list, there were still some small teams that made really great efforts. And in fact, three back-to-back, I have to say, Brandon Brown, Jeremy Clemens, and Brett Moffitt. And I'm just thinking, well, Brett Moffitt runs from the Trucksters and doesn't have – I mean, for the Xfinity Series, the R Motorsports is a fairly new team. And, you know, did really well for an outing. Brandon Brown finishing 12th, Jeremy Clemens finishing 13th, and Brett Moffitt finishing 14th, and then Colby Howard and Johnny Davis Motorsports, the best car they've had finished, and a 15th, four small teams in the top 15, and all of them with not the best equipment, but still outdoing people like Austin Cindric, Riley Herbst, and even, you know, some other big guys up there.
Oh, yeah, no. And you've got to always be impressed with the little teams in the Xfinity Series because they do so much more with so much less. And that is what I love about the series. It's the drivers, it's the team owners like Johnny Davis that are investing in this lower division, or like Jeremy Clemens continuing to run for his own team. That's when you love to see those teams do good because they are giving back to the Xfinity Series. You know, the Cup Series teams, they've still got their Cup Series successes that they can fall back on. But it's the Xfinity Series team regulars, the drivers and teams that compete week in and week out exclusively in the Xfinity Series, they're the backbone that keeps that series special, that keeps that series competitive. And I don't want to envision a world without the team owners like Johnny Davis because they truly are what gives the Xfinity Series its own unique personality, its own unique players, and really special storylines that can't be replicated by the other two divisions.
Oh, for sure. And I think me, you, and Greg were at Iowa one year when Johnny Davis, Ryan Sieg, and BJ McLeod in Motorsports all had some of the best finishes they ever had. Ryan Sieg getting a second. I believe Johnny Davis getting, I know, a top five for sure. And then BJ McLeod Motorsports finishing the best car 11th. All small teams finishing top 10 in the night race, and the three of us were there to see it, and it was quite crazy. Actually, if I remember correctly, that's the one that Sam Hornish Jr. was racing for Roger Penske, wrecked early on in the race, and then we had some great racing after that. Sorry, Sam.
Yeah, I know. I think you're right on that.
Too bad. Too bad.
You know, one driver I really want to highlight tonight, he's a driver that took a lot of beat. Like a lot of negative, I feel like, feedback, and it's been dogged on a lot this season, and I, in my opinion, been unfairly so, and that's Noah Gragson. Since winning the Daytona 100, and it's been kind of an up-and-down year for him. I mean, he's had really solid results. If you look at a comparison to his first eight races in 2019 as a rookie compared to this year, he's got Last year, he only had one top five and two top tens to start the year. This year, he's got three top fives, two wins, and a top ten. And the other finishes were at 11th and 26th place at California. So a really strong start for the number nine in junior motorsports. But he's been kind of, you know, bashed on a lot for his driving style. And a lot of that heat stemmed from the Las Vegas race, where he quite blatantly took out Myatt Snyder. So obviously, the criticism was earned there. And, you know, he learned from it. He apologized. He sat down with his team owner and really took an inward look at, you know, what he did wrong on that and where he should go from there. And honestly, he's driven hard, but I don't think he's driven dirty in any of the races since that Las Vegas incident. But then, you know, the conversation about his driving style came back up after the wreck with Justin Allgaier last week, which ended up, you know, paving the way for him to take his first win at Bristol. And, you know, just the backlash from that and a lot of the blame being pinned on him, I think was completely unfair. Because if you look at the incident, at least the way I've looked at the incident, he didn't do anything wrong. It was a racing incident. He held his line on the bottom. Allgaier pinched him down coming into the entry of the corner and didn't give him a lot of room when the air got, you know, taken off the number nine car. So I feel like just as much blame should be put on Allgaier for that incident, but that wasn't the case. So many drivers, including his own team owner, Dale Jr. on his podcast, you know, criticized the young Las Vegas driver as being too aggressive, you know, using up his teammate, taking advantage of his teammate. And I just think that was completely uncalled for. And, you know, throughout the season, a lot of the media focus, and as far as the driver that's had the most momentum, the driver that's done really well this season, a lot of that spotlight has been shined on Chase Briscoe, which arguably should be the case. Briscoe is your point leader, and he has two wins. But if you look at the standings, 4 points behind Briscoe is Noah Gragson, who also has two victories this season. And comparing the two, you know, I feel like they should be both talked about in the same regard as being, you know, obviously the two favorites for how they've been running consistently in the top five and top 10, competing for wins week in and week out. But yet it seems like an unfair spotlight, you know, shift has been mostly shining on Chase Briscoe. And then, you know, Noah Gragson's been kind of left to the Twitter trolls to kind of pick apart every move he has on the track. And I don't know, Zach, maybe I'm too much in my own head on this. Maybe I've, you know, taken maybe too much of a personal look at this, but I really feel like Noah Gragson's gotten the shit end of the stick all season long and has taken a lot of, in my opinion, unwarranted criticism and is not getting the credit that he's due so far.
I think the big thing that's causing that, because honestly, and again, you brought up great points, his wins, his stats, everything's for a great season. He's 4 points behind Chase Briscoe. By the way, the next person, Harrison Burton, is 32 points behind Noah Gragson. So it definitely is that, you know, people aren't looking at it. But I think the big thing that people are – or the big reason, I guess, is the best way to say it, that people aren't looking at him like that is because of what happened at Las Vegas. Because of what he did, if he wouldn't have spun Myatt Snyder, or if he would have just left it alone, or even just bumped him, not even spun him out, just bumped him, I think this would be a completely, you know, we'd be talking about him in a completely different limelight. We wouldn't be talking about him, oh, he did this and did that. It'd be, oh, did you see that? He won. Oh, did you see that? He had a great finish. But I think that's a big thing that the Twitter trolls and the racing people are saying, like, well, he did advance in Las Vegas and blah, blah, blah. And then, I'm not wrong. I am truly not wrong.
No, I'm sorry.
You
that was funny. That was funny.
And that's the thing is that a lot of people hold that, you know, when you spin someone out intentionally. Now, if it was Kyle Busch, maybe a different story, but it wasn't. But in all honesty, if he hadn't spun Myatt Snyder out in Las Vegas, the second race of the year, and I'm going to emphasize it that way too, it was the second race of the year. It wasn't for, you know, bonus points. It wasn't for this. It wasn't for that. It was the second race of the year. If he hadn't done that, I think a lot of people would probably ease off him for a lot of things. you know, he has a lot of talent, and I've even said this to you last week. I'm impressed how he's actually changed, and maybe if he would have ran a second year in or another year in trucks, maybe he'd be a contender for a truck championship instead of moving up to Cup. I can't say that, you know, I can't say for sure whether or not he would, but I feel like he would have been if he had this progression in the truck series. But, again, that's the big reason why I think people are talking about him this way is because of what he did at Las Vegas. If it was later in the year, probably not. But yeah, I mean, that's how I feel about it.
Well, no, you raise a good point, you know, about that. But I guess the thing that really bugs me so much about it and really irks me a lot is the double standard of it all. I mean, because Noah Gragson is not the first driver to intentionally take someone out. He's not the first. He won't be the last. And so that part bugs me, especially when you consider drivers, you know, in the past that have been kind of celebrated for that hard-nosed style. But when the announcers, you know, specifically talk about him during broadcast, they talk about his aggressive driving style, and there's such a negative tone to their voice. But then, you know, literally a few laps later, the camera will pan, and, you know, here comes Ross Chastain, who has a very similar, you know, aggressive style, a very aggressive nature about him. But the tone is completely different with Ross Chastain. And it's that double standard, that complete lack of self-awareness on that double standard that really has pissed me off. And I think I even took it a little more personally because I'm a huge Earnhardt Jr. fan. He was my biggest role model growing up as a kid, you know, and I'm not afraid to, you know, disagree with him on things, but hearing him talk about, you know, Noah the few times, being the team owner, I get that he's in a different position, but it's just like, you know, Dale, do you not see the double standard you're holding your own driver to when you, you know, praise your father for that same, you know, kind of iron head mentality, that same aggressive nature that put your car in a hole, you know, if it's open because you might, sometimes it comes out bad, but a lot of times you win races. You know, I think it's more so the double standard of it all that really bugs me, especially because Noah Gragson's the kind of driver the sport needs right now. He's great on social media. He's great at interacting with his fans. His Victory Lane interviews are some of the most memorable, some of the most genuine, joy-filled celebrations. And that aggressive style, while it can be controversial, that's what puts butts in the seats. That's what brings the excitement meter up. So that's just where I've been at with that this whole week, and it's just really, really bugged me about it, and especially after an impressive run in Atlanta where he was solidly in the top five all race long, finished second. He was the top finishing driver in the Dash for Cash program, which if you're not familiar with that program, it's put on by Xfinity, the title sponsor for four races. They take they used the finishing order from Bristol, the four top finishing Xfinity-only drivers to pick who were their Dash for Cash eligible drivers, and the program is the top finishing one of those four drivers wins $100,000 as a bonus. And he took away that bonus, even though for much of the race they talked about Austin Cindric, Chase Briscoe, and I can't remember who the fourth driver was competing for it. Harrison Burton. They talked a lot about those three drivers and really didn't, you know, talk much during the broadcast, at least in my opinion, about Noah Gragson, you know, being in contention for that Dash for Cash, and then he wins the damn thing, and still I don't think, you know, was given the proper due credit for that. So it's just, I don't know, it's been bugging me all week, and this is my platform to bitch about it. No one's going to hear me bitch about it, but it makes me feel better about bitching about it.
Well, I heard you bitch.
There we go.
There
you guys got to be my soundboard because I got a lot of NASCAR angst and nowhere to vent it. So that's what
matter.
You guys are here for.
Doesn't Dr. John matter? Now don't get me in trouble saying that. Oh my God. Okay, hey guys, how you doing?
I feel it, and I'm going to say it like this. I feel like he might be a lot like one of his first bosses he ever really had, who was none other but Kyle Busch. Kyle has the same real driving style. Maybe he learned it from Kyle, and his celebration is memorable, that is for sure. But I think you're right. The media and everyone, and even the people on Twitter, and even his own boss needs to be like, hey, wait a second. Maybe I need to rethink this whole thing. He is a great driver. I think he's also matured, which is one thing to say for sure. But I think one big thing he needs to do is not feed in to those Twitter trolls so much. And just
you're right. He's got a lot of maturing to do. He's only 21 years old. Like, I remember being 21. I didn't always make the best decisions either. So you could also cut the kid a break. He's still very, very young and got a lot of maturing to do. And I feel like he'll get there.
Didn't we meet when you were 21?
I think so. No, it's younger than that. We met right around when we were both 18. Cause we're the same age, Zach.
Wait, I'm 26.
I'm 26.
I'm not.
Huh. You don't say.
Yeah, I
do. We talk about this every time. Goodness gracious, you need to work on that memory, boy.
Dude, I can barely remember my name. I have to look inside my underwear. Sometimes it's Freakaloon, sometimes it's Zach.
You know, it'll be like that. Well, let's get down to the finishing order of these fantasy series so we can get on to this.
One more thing I want to say is we with the cautions and everything, we didn't have as many, just like the trucks and the lead changes. And one thing I want to say is, do you think that might be because we didn't have any Cup Series regulars in this, or do you think that it was just that good of a racing? Because I compared the truck and the Xfinity Series really close because the run time was fairly close, within 20 minutes of each other. And they didn't have the Truck Series had two Cup Series guys, and the trucks or the Xfinity did not.
I really don't think that had a lot of bearing on it. I mean, the Xfinity Series I just felt like was way down on action throughout the day. I just think it's more attributed to the Xfinity Series car, because we've seen on these mile and a half tracks with this current car that's run in the Xfinity Series that's been on the circuit since 2010. It's sometimes it's really great. Other times the racing is just kind of meh. And I feel like it was just more a difference in how the Xfinity Series car drives compared to the truck. The trucks are a lot looser, they're a lot lighter, and you can easily get side by side a lot more in an event with those vehicles. Whereas the Xfinity Series, they're a little more planted. Granted, they have a lower downforce package than the other two divisions, but I just feel like the car itself doesn't lend itself to the best of racing, at least out of the top three divisions.
Okay, was just curious.
Well, let's take you down that full field rundown before Zach brings us over to the Cup Series event. Like we said, AJ Allmendinger came away with the top spot. Noah Gragson finished in second. Justin Haley came across the line in third. Daniel Hemric in fourth. Harrison Burton came across the line fifth. Brandon Jones, Justin Allgaier sixth. Ross Chastain in seventh. Brandon Jones eighth. Chase Briscoe in ninth. Anthony Alfredo rounded out your top 10. Michael Annett, the homeboy from Iowa, came home in 11th. Brandon Brown, 12th. Jeremy Clements in 13th. Brett Moss, the other Iowa boy, in 14th. Colby Howard in 15th. Austin Cindric, 16th. Riley Herbst, 17th, after getting into the outside wall off of turn 2 on lap 70. Bailey Curry in 18th. Ronnie Bassett Jr. came across the line 19th. Jesse Little rounded out the top 20. Jeffrey Earnhardt came across the line 21st. Tommy Joe Martins in 22nd. Mason Massey in 23rd. Garrett Smithley in 24th. DJ McLeod in 25th. Joe Graff Jr. 26th. Alex LeBay 27th. Josh Williams came across the line 28th. Myatt Snyder in 29th. And Matt Mills rounded out the top 30. Your final finishers of the afternoon were Matt Mills in 31st. Joe Nemechek in 32nd. Timmy Hill, 33rd, Chad Fincham in 34th, Ryan Sieg, after an engine let go on his Chevrolet, came home a dismal 35th, Stephen Lyon came home in 36th, and Cody Vanderwall finished in 37th.
With another engine failure.
And they've been his crux this season. He's had some really solid runs, but he's mired 10th in the points due to some very untimely engine failures in that 39 Chevrolet, so hopefully they can get the durability a little bit up so we can be factoring in for a few more wins, hopefully, this rest of the year.
That is for sure. But that brings us to the Folds of Honor Quick Trip 500. How was just that Quick Trip? Those corn dogs are really good. 300.
Quick Trip, heck yes, they are. And so's the chicken salad sandwiches.
Ooh. 325 laps, 3 hours, 30 minutes and 3 seconds was your race time. Not a lot of cautions, again. And it was kind of weird. The two cautions that weren't competition or end stage, Front Row Motorsports, both John Hunter Nemechek and Michael McDowell, my favorite, both going around in circles. But other than that, a lot of lead changes, for sure. And I got to say, it was quite an interesting race, to say the least. And I don't think that's a statement. I think it's a statement even you would agree with. Am I right, Brady?
What?
Oh, yeah, no. Like, while the caution flags were definitely down, the action was not. If you look at the green flag passes, the NASCAR loop data on this, there was an average of 9.9 green flag passes a lap, which is a pass and a half per lap more than the Xfinity Series. So by comparison to the Xfinity Series, there was definitely more side-by-side action. And we had quite a few fights for the lead. However, it seemed like once the driver got out front, which has been the kind of the case in a lot of mile-and-a-half races with the Gen 6 car, it was really hard to pass the leader. But behind him, the racing action never really died down that much. We saw a lot of great side-by-side racing throughout the mid-pack, throughout the bottom half of the top 10. And even at times, we saw drivers four wide on the front stretch because they were really getting after it. But, it was kind of a tale of two different races. Martin Truex Jr., you know, he led 65 laps and was in prime position towards the end of long run as he swept both stage one and stage two. However, he was not really the dominant driver of the afternoon. That honor belongs to Kevin Harvick, the number four Premier Ford. He led 151 of the 325 laps, so way, way more laps than anyone else in the field. And even though he didn't win any of the stages, he took home the bigger honor. He took home the trophy, his third win at the Atlanta mile-and-a-half track there in Hampton, Georgia, the site of his very first career victory in the Cup Series, this one being his 51st win. And he celebrated in similar fashion to that first win with three fingers out the door in a salute to Dale Earnhardt, the driver that he took over for in 2001 after the tragic crash at Daytona. And it's been kind of his tradition. He's only won there three times at the track, but all three times he's done the same Polish-style victory lap where he drives the car in reverse, three fingers out in a salute to the memory of Dale Earnhardt. And it was so cool to see him take that victory, his 51st, which is such a milestone win in the Cup Series. I'll have to look up where that puts him on the all-time Cup wins list, but that, you know, puts him past drivers like Ned Jarrett, Junior Johnson, who only had 50 wins in their Cup Series. Those are two really big names right there. Pulling it up now. There's got to be a better list than this. Yeah, go for it, Zach.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Kevin's been a dominant car there, or dominant driver at Atlanta for years. Now, he doesn't have as many wins, but his stats there are pretty decent for himself. And any time he is there, he is a force to be reckoned with. That is something we, for sure, and I mean this, not just as a spectator, but as a fan, you look at his, I guess the best way to put it, and the best way to put it forward, is he is one hell of a driver at any track, but you go to Atlanta, he's someone that has figured that track out, especially how much grip there is and there isn't. He somehow could take a car, get off the throttle to start finish line, coast it essentially all the way to turn one and two, and still extend the lead. What other driver have you seen or heard be able to do that?
It's very rare, and his knack for Atlanta really shone in the Xfinity Series, where he's a multi-time winner in that division, wins for Richard Childress Racing, wins for his own team, wins for Junior Motorsports. It was just always a track that really suited his driving style, because you really have to drive it on the ragged edge and really have to push it to the max of your ability, which Kevin Harvick has a lot of. It's no coincidence that his very first Cup Series win came at this track, one of the most difficult on the series. And I looked it up. His 51st win, that's him 12th on the all-time Cup Series win list. Like I said, that puts him ahead of a three-way tie at one point he had with Ned Jarrett and Junior Johnson, two Hall of Fame drivers in their own right, who had the round-off 50 wins in their career, and ahead of his boss and team owner, Tony Stewart, who had 49 wins. But that puts him behind in striking distance of drivers like Lee Petty, who have 54, Rusty Wallace, who has 55, and a current competitor that he's competing against, Kyle Busch, with 56. So Harvick just continues to just be a solid figure so far this season. He's been quiet, not really put himself in a lot of, like, major conversations, but he's really been owning up to his nickname, the closer. And if you look at his 2020 stats, only one finish so far this year has been outside the top 10, and that was last week at Bristol, where he finished 11th. But aside from that, his finishes are 5th at Daytona, 8th at Las Vegas, 9th at California, 2nd at Phoenix, the win at Darlington, 3rd at Darlington again, 5th at Charlotte, the 10th place at Charlotte last Thursday, and then a win this last weekend in Atlanta to go along with that 11th place at Bristol. So just super, super consistent, almost as consistent as his 2018 campaign, which arguably should have ended in a championship for him as dominant as he was that last year in 2018. So you got to keep a close eye on him. If he now joins Brad Keselowski, Joey Logano, and Denny Hamlin in the two win club for 2020, it's a very exclusive club, but it seems to be growing week in and week out there.
Yeah, it won't be so exclusive getting towards the halfway mark. But just to give you a reference on this, Atlanta Motor Speedway for Kevin Harvick, 30 races, wins, he has 3, top 5s, 9, and this one is one that is just incredible. Top 10s, for every 2 races he has started there, he's finished in the top 10, 15 top 10 finishes and 2 pole awards, and led also 1,348 laps combined over the years. And he's finished 9,542 laps. So Atlanta, that right there, half your starts are top 10s. Not many drivers have that at a lot of tracks. Kevin Harvick has quite a few of them where he has that. But even in Atlanta, not a lot of drivers have that.
Oh, not at all. And we also saw a lot more performance and speed out of the Toyota camp this last week. You and I have kind of talked these last few weeks that we just haven't seen the full raw-out speed from the Camrys that we're used to seeing from these last few years. But we kind of saw them back in, more of a traditional form at Atlanta. Kyle Busch was out front for 7 laps, but solidly in the top 5 for most of the event. And then, like I said, Martin Truex Jr. led the second most laps with 65 and swept both stages, which also puts him well ahead of everyone else for the most amount of stage victories since the implementation of that format in 2017. He's got 8 stage wins more than the next closest competitor, which I believe is Kyle Busch. So definitely they're starting to turn the corner in their camp. They also had Denny Hamlin in the top 5 with a 5th place finish. So 3 drivers from the Toyota camp with solid races that were desperately needed, especially these last few weeks where they just really haven't seemed like they've carried a lot of speed at the tracks.
I'm going to say right now, Toyota listened to me when I said something about the Toyota body. They got it fixed. That's all I'm going to say. But you're right. Toyota themselves have improved. Now, and again, we do have to keep saying this over and over again. We're still early on in the season. We technically would be pretty close to halfway at this point in the season. So it's kind of weird how the season's played out so far. But we're still having discoveries and new things, but Toyota improved significantly. We're 10 races in, so we're just about a third of the way in of the season, and Toyota has now kind of stepped up more. Atlanta isn't always a place that Toyota is really good at, especially in the Cup Series, but they showed it off pretty well. And by the way, the other Toyotas, Eric Jones and Christopher Bell finishing 18th, Eric Jones finishing 28th in the Joe Gibbs stable, I should say. And yes, the 95 of Levine Family Racing has a technical alliance with Joe Gibbs, so that's why I'm saying it with them. Even though those two weren't, didn't have the best finishes, still 3 drivers in the top 5. It's just like going back to the trucks or Xfinity, getting 3 drivers in the top 5. Holy cow, that's an accomplishment.
Oh, yeah, and let's take you through a rundown of that full-field rundown. Kevin Harvick did claim the victory in his number 4, his second win of the season. Kyle Busch with a strong second-place outing in the number 18 Toyota. Martin Truex Jr. came home in 3rd. Ryan Blaney, a very impressive run for the number 12. He came home in 4th. Denny Hamlin came across the line fifth. Kurt Busch rebounded after his car failed pre-race inspection twice and was forced to start at the back of the field and do a pass-through penalty on the opening lap, leaving him a lap down before really the race even got off to a start. Very impressive comeback by that number one Chevrolet to a sixth-place finish. Jimmy Johnson with a solid outing in seventh, Chase Elliott in eighth, Brad Keselowski came across the line in ninth, and Joey Logano rounded out the top ten. Austin Dillon continuing to build off a very solid campaign so far. He finished 11th. Alex Bowman came across the line 12th. Ricky Stenhouse Jr. had kind of an up-and-down day, but came home with a solid 13th-place finish. Ryan Newman, who was looking absolutely wiped at the end of 500 miles, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute, he salvaged his 14th-place finish. Matt Kenseth, kind of another up-and-down day, not really the return to the Cup Series that he was hoping for. We'll also talk about that here in just a bit, where he came across the line in 15th. Tyler Reddick, 16th. Eric Almirola in 17th. Christopher Bell, 18th. Cole Custer, 19th. And Clint Bowyer in 20th. Bubba Wallace came home 21st. He's been in the news a lot lately, and we'll definitely be talking about that before we wrap up tonight. And also, he was, just like Ryan Newman, completely wiped after the 500 miles, so we'll be talking a little bit more about the health concerns the drivers were facing at Atlanta. But Bubba Wallace brought home the legendary 43 and 21st place position. Chris Buescher came across the line 22nd. John Hunter Nemechek in 23rd. Michael McDowell, Zach's favorite, in 24th. Matt DiBenedetto in 25th. Ryan Preece, 26th. Corey LaJoie in 27th. Eric Jones, 28th. Ty Dillon in 29th. And Brendan Poole rounding out the top 30. Daniel Suarez, a very meh kind of run in the Coca-Cola 96. He finished in 31st. Quinn House in 32nd. William Byron, a dismal 33rd for that driver. Josh Bilicki came home in 34th. Garrett Smithley in 35th. J.J. Yaley finishing 36th. Jones in 37th. Joey Gase in 38th. Timmy Hill, 39th. And B.J. McLeod finished in 40th.
The one thing that I think we need to talk about was Atlanta itself was basically on fire. It was hot at Atlanta. And Brady alluded to that. Both Bubba Wallace and Ryan Newman was exhausted. Bubba Wallace actually fainted when he got out of the car, was midway through an interview with Fox, fainted yet again during a live interview, was rushed to the in-care field center, was given an IV, and was later released. So, you know, if you think these guys are athletes, think about this. They got heat exhaustion. They're running in cars inside the car itself. It's sometimes 130-some-odd degrees. It's hotter than the freaking desert sometimes.
And especially in Atlanta, that means the Georgia heat and the humidity that they have to deal with being right there next to the ocean is just unparalleled to any other track they go, which is why normally this race takes place either in the fall or where it was for a lot of years, or recently being the second race of the season there towards the end of February, early March, when that humidity is a lot more tempered and the temperatures are a lot cooler. But running them right in the smack at the beginning of summer, right in the middle of June there almost, I can't imagine, you know, the pressure these drivers were under and just the immense toll it took on their bodies, especially considering how much we've been racing in the last few weeks. We've run about six races in the last 3 weeks, and that's just a lot of toll on these drivers. And you saw it in his face. Ryan Newman, even though he didn't pass out, he looked just miserable. And for Ryan Newman, if you know him, he's kind of a guy that really carries himself well, just really all the time just looks ready to, you know, just throw down. And for him to just look as pale and just worn out as he did, that's how I knew those drivers, you know, put up one hell of a fight all afternoon long, just battling Mother Nature.
Think what would happen if they run it in August. Gee. Oh, my Lord.
Oh God.
It's just like we're gonna see later on this year, we will have a race in Vegas. Even though it'll be under lights, it's going to be in freaking September. I don't need to say much after that.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a hard pass for me, dog. Hard pass.
And think about it. If I get with a team, I'll have to be in it. No point. And I thought our races at Iowa were hot, but you know, you look at the standings so far, points wise, in the playoffs, we have Kevin Harvick, Joey Logano, Brad Keselowski, and Denny Hamlin all for sure locked in for it. Alex Bowman, who else am I missing? Who's won a race? Chase Elliott is locked in as well. I had to think there for a second. But the cutoff right now, William Byron and Eric Jones are the two drivers on the cutoff line. I know we really don't have to worry much about this because it's not for another 16 races, but that's still something to worry about. Eric Jones and William Byron are 20 points apart. By the way, at one point, they would have been teammates. It's kind of interesting to see this.
Oh, yeah. And I mentioned it in our full field rundown. Matt Kenseth, a 15th place finish. It's not been the comeback that he was hoping for. Aside from a solid 10th place finish in that first Darlington race, he's had finishes at the second Charlotte Motor Speedway race of 23rd, 16th last weekend at Bristol, and he's got a 21st running finishing position average for his five races back. He was quoted as saying it's just been kind of an up-and-down season. He's just trying to get caught back up to speed, limiting his mistakes. And, you know, it's definitely been a challenge for him not having, you know, the ability to meet with his team, not being able to have those practice sessions to really shake down the Camaro and get used to it. But one thing that completely flipped my mind in all the discussion about him coming back was he has really no bearing on this new package because his last full-time season was in 2018 with the low downforce package of campaigned all season long. And so for the four intermediate races that he's run, the two at Darlington, two at Charlotte, and now this last weekend at Atlanta, this is his first, you know, real stab at the brand new aero package with the 550 horsepower and an 8-inch spoiler. And Kenseth, he said, luckily he's been able to kind of compare it to how he drove an Xfinity Series car about 4 or 5 years ago. So he's got at least something, you know, reference-wise that he can compare it to. But this has just been a complete, you know, unexpected series of challenges for the 2003 champion. And he said it's definitely been frustrating, you know, and not quite what he expected in his return. And Zach, kind of what's been your takeaway from Matt Kenseth's comeback to the series?
I think one big thing to take away is that he really hasn't, you know, and you said it right on the head, he hasn't run this package before. And quite a few things have changed since he's left. He was off for an entire full year from racing in general. And then wasn't planning on racing, got a call from Chip Ganassi, said, hey, I want you to run the car because of the situation going on. And not getting any practice, I feel, is a big one for him. You can take anyone, put them in a car they've never ran in before, period. By the way, coming off of a year-long, I'll say, hiatus, telling them, okay, you're going to run this car. Okay, you're not going to get any practice. Okay, you're not going to get any qualifying. Okay, the only practice you're going to get is the actual start of the race. It's a big learning curve, and I mean a lot bigger than normal. A lot of these guys have ran this package before, have ran these tracks before. There's not really many drivers that are rookies besides the actual rookies themselves that haven't ran this package. And, you know, he's used to driving this body style, this kind of car, but not with this package on it. So I feel the biggest hurdle, and you said it, was not getting any practice, but also not meeting with the team. Talk about why stuff is now. So I'm not going to judge him just yet. I'm going to wait to truly judge him five races in when we get some practice time slotted. Whether they only get a 30-minute practice session and that's it, I'll be able to judge more on it. I'm not really going to throw the book at him saying he's not doing what he should be doing. He's doing what he's able to do because he's not too sure what he should be doing at this point. I'm not talking bad about him. Matt, like you said, former champion, one hell of a wheelman. But the circumstances he's in right now just makes it really hard for him to be able to pull off of not just a victory, but a solid finish consistently.
Exactly. And while we had a lot of great racing action on the track and a lot of good storylines that came from that racing action, arguably one of the biggest storylines that came from the Sunday afternoon race was what happened right before the green flag, and something that I've only ever seen NASCAR do to acknowledge the military and thank them for their service. NASCAR, right before we took the green flag, stopped all 40 cars on the warm-up pace lap on the front stretch in front of the empty grandstands, had all the drivers shut off their engines, and NASCAR President Steve Phelps patched into the driver radio and gave a message not only to the drivers but to all the fans sitting at home, kind of to address everything we've seen in the country this last week and really address NASCAR's position in it. If you're a NASCAR fan, you know exactly what the stereotypes are out there. Arguably, the sport has deep-seated roots that tie with racism, with white supremacy, and NASCAR as a sport has really done a lot to try and distance itself from that past, to try and learn from those mistakes, learn from those shortcomings, and really truly be a sport that's open and to everyone and be as inclusive as they possibly could be. And I'll read you what Steve Phelps, our president, said about everything going on. He said, quote, "Thank you for your time. Our country is in pain and people are justifiably angry, demanding to be heard. The black community and all people of color have suffered in our country, and it has taken far too long for us to hear their demands for change. Our sport must do better. Our country must do better. This time is now a time to listen, to understand, and to stand against racism and racial injustice. We ask our drivers and all our fans to join us in this mission, to take a moment of reflection, to acknowledge that we must do better as a sport, and join us now as we pause and take a moment to listen." And it was at that moment that the drivers, the Fox broadcast crew, observed a 30-second moment of silence. And then they played a very, very strong message, a compilation video, where they pulled some top series, cup series drivers, including a retired superstar, Dale Earnhardt Jr., to deliver a message to the fans that we need to hold ourselves more accountable. And especially now more than ever, with the country so divided, and with even our own, you know, shortcomings and missteps in the last few months with the Kyle Larson controversy. I mean, that whole controversy has shown a light that while we've done great things, you know, in the last decade or so to really try and push for the Drive for Diversity program, our sport still has a very, very long way to go to shed some of those more, you know, unhappier times in our history and those more racially charged times in our history. And I was very taken aback. I didn't expect that kind of response from the sport. I really did not see that kind of response happening under the Brian France era. And I really applaud this new sanctioning body led by Steve Phelps, led by Jim France, that are really trying to push NASCAR in a positive direction and really try to address some of the more, you know, controversial and not so pleasant memories, to try and learn from them, make us better, and make us more inclusive, because the diversity that makes this country great has what's made this sport great these last years. And I'm so happy that NASCAR is, you know, willing to admit that we are not perfect and we are nowhere near close to where we should be. And even more special today, myself being a member of the LGBTQI community, NASCAR also announced a very big moment today where they are, in recognition of Pride Month, they're going to participate in the inaugural You Can Play Pride Auction, which is this wonderful auction started up this year to try and ensure equality, respect, and safety for all athletes in all sports with regards to sexual orientation and or gender identity. It's a program designed to support the LGBTQ plus community by building a network around them. And it's in that spirit that You Can Play launched its inaugural Pride Auction, where NASCAR is going to be donating some race tickets, some VIP experiences, and some signed driver helmets to benefit this cause. And from what I can tell from the press release, they're the only full sanctioning bodied sport to be participating in this auction. NFL has got a couple of teams, most notably the Los Angeles Chargers, that are going to be donating to this cause. The NHL has the Dallas Stars, the Detroit Red Wings, and NBA's got the Toronto Raptors, and the National Women's Hockey League is also participating in it. And it's just that self-reflection that I've really applauded about our sport, because we could be doing a lot better, because the sport is great. And I don't understand why we wouldn't want to share it with everyone, because this sport honestly has become as much a part of my identity and what people know me about. And I love to share it with people, and I just don't understand a world where we want to keep people excluded from that. So I applaud NASCAR for trying to take these bold steps, and they're going to really be, you know, focusing on their Drive for Diversity program and doing what's most important that we all should be doing during this time of the country, listening to those that have been really hurt these last few weeks, really listening to the outcry, the pain of people just wanting to be heard. And I just think we could all take a lesson from that. And so I was really, really proud this week to be a NASCAR fan with just the response that we've been pushing forward and just our never-ending efforts to try and shed some of those stereotypes that we're bigots, that we don't care about our fellow man, because that's simply not true. If you look at any team in that garage area, they will do anything they can for any member that needs help. And it's nice to see the sanctioning body trying to really put that at the forefront.
It definitely is a good thing to see, you know, especially with quote unquote what people see NASCAR and you ask people, what about Formula One? What about this? They say, oh, they're far ahead. They're this. It's like, no, it's all across the board. There are issues. And it's great to see really one of the biggest sports in America. I know people say, well, the NFL, this and this. If you look at NASCAR, they have not only the longest series or the longest season across the board, their sub-series also have quite lengthy series. They go to many different states, many different even countries, going to Canada for race. It's just as a whole, NASCAR is coming together to make a change and to show that, yeah, we're not like this. And, you know, the black eye that we gotten this year with Kyle Larson is not a good one. It's not a good example, but you see the backlash and how fast, not just NASCAR, but just about everyone else in the racing world took to be like, yeah, this is not okay. Definitely is a great step forward. And NASCAR itself is a place I'm glad I could definitely say I'm going to be a part of and have been a part of for, golly, many, many years. And it will definitely be interesting to see what people are going to do next in the good way, not the bad way, the good way. And we can't wait to see not just race in action, bring families, but bring people together, period.
And with that, kind of trying to, you know, look towards a place of openness and trying to really, you know, bring us together, Bubba Wallace, I really have to applaud him. He's unfairly, you know, been the leader for the NASCAR movement and the one that we've been looking to for guidance. And he has stepped into that role with compassion, humility, and just straight up honesty, which is what his fans have always endeared and loved him for. It's just his, you know, blunt honesty and his willingness to admit mistakes, but also, you know, stand up for what he believes in. And I really love the relationship that not only he has with his fans, but with our king, Richard Petty. He drives the famous 43, and you see it all the time. Those two are constantly just like leaning on each other. You know, Richard Petty has really taken an interest in helping Bubba's career, and kind of a perfect culmination to everything that NASCAR is trying to do to really try and make the sport better. It's all going to kind of come together during tomorrow night's race. Bubba Wallace in the 43 car is running a very special paint scheme. It's an all-black paint scheme. It's got the hashtag Black Lives Matter on the quarter panels, on the hood. It's a beautifully drawn symbol of a black hand and a white hand reaching out and grasping in unity. And below the image on the hood is the hashtag Compassion, Love, and Understanding, which is what we all need to do right now. And on the very far, smaller rear quarter of the car, right behind the rear tires, there's also a peace symbol that's made up of a bunch of different colored hands. And I found out watching the press release that particular addition to the paint scheme was actually suggested by Richard Petty, which I did not know this about Petty, but during the 60s and 70s, during obviously some of the more tougher times in our country's history, Richard Petty ran a peace symbol on a lot of his number 43 cars in kind of recognition of what the country was going through. And so it was really neat to see that not only did Bubba have a hand in designing this car, but also the team owner, Richard Petty, you know, threw his own touch in there to really truly make it what the car is supposed to be about bringing us all together and unifying us under compassion, love, and the need to just better understand each other.
That's a great closing comment. It really is. We got 30 seconds left, so I'm going to give everybody 10 seconds, and then we'll be back next week. Zach, what were you going to say in 10 seconds?
Watts Martinsville, eat a hot dog. It's a night race. Get ready for some fights.
Awesome. Brady, what you got in 10 seconds?
Got to echo what Zach said. It's Martinsville, baby. It's under the lights. Do not miss it. 6 o'clock on Fox Sports 1. If you can't watch it there, watch the recap on YouTube. It's worth it.
All right, guys. We'll see everybody next Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, on the Charlotte Line.
We're going to have a lot.